Welcome back to the MJA podcast. I'm Kate Swanell. In February of 2019, the Queensland Parliament passed the Human Rights Act, the third Australian jurisdiction to do so. What makes the Queensland Act unique, however, is the inclusion of the right to health services, otherwise known as Section 37. Section 37 mandates two things. First, that every person has the right to access health services without discrimination. And second, that a person must not be refused emergency medical treatment that is immediately necessary to save the person's life or to prevent serious impairment to the person. Dr. Claire Brolin from the University of Queensland Centre for Policy Futures has written a perspective for the MJA about Section 37 and the Human Rights Act, which came into effect on the 1st of January 2020. Megan Fairweather is Senior Counsel with Minter Ellison and is an expert in health law and human rights law. Claire and Megan are my special guests today as we talk about the new Act and the impact of COVID-19 on our right to health. When did Queensland's new Human Rights Act come into law?
It was actually in February 2019 when the Queensland Parliament passed the Human Rights Act, but it actually took effect and entered into law on the 1st of January 2020.
Given that the right to healthcare is already in the Australian Charter of Healthcare Rights, why did the right to health need to be explicitly added to the Human Rights Act?
That's a really good question, Kate. One of the key reasons is that law and policy and principles are two very different entities. Hard law is enforceable, yep, and it generates far greater accountability around issues with government, whereas policy, there's a lot of wiggle room and limited remedy and enforcement mechanisms at times. So although we have already an Australian Charter of Healthcare Rights and a Charter on the Rights of Children and Young People and Healthcare Services in Australia, and while these are very important documents, these are not hard law documents. The health rights as expressed in those documents aren't actually law. That's where this new Act and Section 37 of the Human Rights Act of Queensland has really shifted the dial, because now the right to access health services without discrimination, at least in the Queensland context, is with legal consequence. And this is particularly important for the effective monitoring, accountability and enforcement of health and human rights for all Queenslanders, and particularly for Queensland's First Nations people.
I was just going to add that it's really exciting for Queensland to have this right embedded into the Human Rights Act, because we're the third jurisdiction in Australia to introduce a human rights in our local laws, and we're the first in Australia to introduce the right to access healthcare.
Right.
So it's green fields. It's been tested in Queensland. We haven't seen anything yet, but we are excited that we are leading the way in having this right embedded into our local legislation.
So what does it mean on the ground for patients? Particularly, let's talk about Indigenous populations, for example. What exactly does it mean for a patient to have this right in law, and how do they call on it if they need to?
So if we could talk generally perhaps first, we've been advising, and the way we interpret the way the right has been framed in Section 37 of the Human Rights Act, that the outcomes are probably going to be much the same. We are very privileged in Australia. We have an effective public health system under Medicare. We've got agreements between our state and the Commonwealth to ensure that people do have good access to healthcare, including in emergencies. But the way the Human Rights Act is designed, it's how we get there, how we get to those outcomes, is what has changed by the legislation. So that public entities, including the Department of Health at a policy level, down to frontline staff, will need to follow a human rights decision tree when they're taking actions and making decisions. So they have to think to themselves, will my decision engage or effectively limit any of the human rights that are protected under the legislation? And there are 23 of those. And if so, they have to ask themselves, well, is this limit reasonable and demonstrably justifiable in a free and democratic society based on human dignity, equality and freedom? And that's in accordance with Section 13 of the Act. We think in the public sector, the health sector is probably very well placed to comply with the Human Rights Act overall, but especially this Section 37 access to healthcare rights, because the health sector is managed by caring and compassionate professionals who are generally in the business of looking after people and their health.
I just wanted to go back to the question about how this section could be of benefit for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Queenslanders. So I'm a right to health specialist, originally trained in international human rights law. My PhD is in public health and my postdoc is actually on the right to health. And what I can say is, having really looked closely at how the right to health has been domesticated in international jurisdictions, the right to health is actually, in fact, embedded in over 100 constitutions nationally.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not necessarily a new right.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, certainly on Australian shores it is, but internationally it's not. And from my international experience, there are a number of ways that I foresee that this right could be of enormous benefit for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Queenslanders. In terms of generating, when complaints are made, when it comes to experiences of discrimination,
yep.
whether that's indirect or direct discrimination, when it comes to accessing health services, there is likely to be greater accountability and greater transparency around those complaints. That is a matter of law now. So that is a really, really positive outcome of having Section 37 in law. And so there will be far more agencies, Indigenous, non-Indigenous, being able to scrutinise the complaints before the Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And working with different government agencies and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities and leaders in Queensland to develop health systems and health services responses in terms of policy and planning. And hopefully there'll be greater, through Section 37, greater participatory governance and self-determination by and for First Nations Queenslanders in terms of crafting health services policy and planning to respond to their specific health needs in different parts of Queensland, which have very, very different health landscapes.
Yeah.
The second thing I think is really important is that, for example, before the Human Rights Act came into play, if you had a complaint about a health practitioner or health service, the individual as a complainant could go to the Health Ombudsman under the Health Ombudsman Act. But my concern with that particular act is that it does not recognise the special importance that human rights and, by extension, health and human rights, an accessible, non-discriminatory health service provision has for Queensland, Aboriginal peoples and Torres Strait Islander peoples. I think on this point, as I've actually noted in my article, that there is no reason why the definition of health services in terms of its elements, you know, what constitutes access, what constitutes health services,
yep.
what constitutes non-discrimination in Section 37.1, could not be interpreted to integrate a more culturally responsive meaning for Queensland's Indigenous peoples, which
yes.
is consistent with the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples.
But the Human Rights Act does have special recognition for our First Australians.
Mm-hmm.
The preamble sets up that human rights belong to everybody, but that it recognises that that human rights have a special importance for Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people in Queensland.
Yeah.
With their distinctive and diverse spiritual, material and economic relationship with lands, territories and other resources. And to add to that, to bolster that preamble and to give effect to it, drawing through the actual provisions and protections in the Act is Section 28, which are the special cultural rights for Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander, and
mm-hmm.
again, building in a distinct recognition for their special connection to land and kinship ties and the like, which will tie in with the right to access health services.
I completely agree, Megan, and I would, as a right to health specialist, encourage that Section 37 complaints lodged by First Nations Queenslanders are also lodged in concurrency to a sort of Section 28 cultural rights complaints, because health is, my understanding for our First Nations peoples is so deeply embedded in their spiritual practices and beliefs and into connection with the land and culture. So, yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of interconnection in years to come with respect to Section 28 and Section 37 claim.
There's a huge elephant in the room, and that is COVID-19. We are sitting in a situation right now where there's every chance, if you believe the modelling and the experts, that hospital ICUs are going to get overwhelmed. There are going to be more people needing ICU beds than there are going to be ICU beds. How does Section 37 deal with the decisions that are going to have to be made about who gets a ventilator and who doesn't?
I think there's probably three parts to that question, Kate. Mm-hmm. And I think, first of all, for people on the ground, there are policies and guidelines that have been developed and that will be constantly updated to make these difficult decisions possible for the frontline staff.
Yeah.
And to expand on existing triage systems, not only to assist with prioritising patients who might need COVID-19 testing or treatment, but also to keep the rest of the healthcare system going. We still have emergency and trauma. People still need cancer treatment. People are still having babies. Children are still getting broken arms and the like. And we do have significant but not infinite public resources to cope with all of this, and we expect our governments to manage them all quite responsibly. And if I can call on a case that was handed down in South Africa by the name of Subramoney, mm-hmm. it's a great example of where a court will uphold the idea that public resources are finite, and that decisions about allocation of those resources should be left to the government, as long as there is a considered and rational policy for the patient, the patients who need access to those limited resources.
Right.
So, yes, I imagine up ahead we will have some difficult decisions to be made, but as long as they're made in accordance with a structured and rational policy, that should be okay.
Yeah.
And consistent with this Section 37 right to access health care. The second part to that is we do have a Public Health Act in Queensland, and one of the key objectives, if you like, of that act is to limit individual rights and freedoms in order to meet overall public health objectives for the benefit of everybody in an emergency like this. I've explained before, I think, that the human rights are not absolute. They can be limited where there's a reasonable and demonstrably justifiable basis. So by imposing limits to these freedoms, then some of these individual freedoms, the Section 37 access to healthcare right, as well as the right to life, are effectively being promoted and protected above those other rights. It's designed to alleviate the pressures being caused by the COVID-19. Third, we have this requirement for Parliament to take human rights into account when they're tabling new legislation or amending legislation, and we saw that last week with the urgent amendments to the Public Health Act that were introduced. If you go to the Parliament website, the compatibility statement that was written to go with the amending legislation to the Public Health Act, there's been a very careful analysis of each of the human rights that are going to be impacted by this new world we find ourselves in and all the limits to the individual rights that are being enacted. It's a really comprehensive document where they've raised all of the individual rights and they've explained why in this case it's more important or reasonable or justifiable to override those other rights in favour of public health. Instead of, they do have the option to introduce legislation with an override power, it's called. And that's where the Parliament has permission under the Human Rights Act to table something that says, we know this legislation is in breach of the Human Rights Act, but we're going to do it anyway because it's an acute public emergency that we need to address. They chose not to do that. They actually chose to go through the process of making sure that this legislation is compatible with the Human Rights Act. And I think that is a real signal to the public at large that they take the Act very seriously.
I'd like to really second Megan's thoughts on the Parliament's actions. I think that what they did was enormously measured and enormously supportive of Queensland's new Human Rights Act. I'd like to add a few points to the discussion and some of the key aspects of Megan's points just then, is that while there are general limitations on rights, and Section 37 on the new Queensland Human Rights Act says that, yes, rights can be limited when that is reasonably and demonstrably justifiable to do that. In history, human rights have been limited lawfully, particularly in times of war and times of public health emergency.
Yes.
So that's what we're seeing now. But it is also arguable that certain human rights should not be limited, even in times of war and public health emergency. These are rights, for example, that are considered just cogens norms. That's a bit of a fancy term in international human rights law that refers to those types of rights protected in international human rights law that are considered higher order rights. So, for example, yes, in times of emergency, such as public health emergency, we can have our rights limited, such as our freedom of movement, our mm-hmm. right to freedom of movement. But when it comes to just cogens norms, clearly we still our right not to face torture, for example, which is considered a just norm, our right not to experience slavery, another just cogent norm. These are considered non-derogable and still must be rights that are respected and promoted. So, yes, well, we can, in times of emergency, bring, and governments can introduce limitations on rights. Mm-hmm. I would question the Human Rights Act's phrasing that certain rights are not absolute. I think certain rights, certainly in international human rights law, are considered to be absolute, such as the right not to face torture and the right not to experience slavery.
I'm chatting today with Claire Brolin from the University of Queensland and Megan Fairweather from Minter Ellison. Claire's MJA article is available at mja.com.au. The MJA has instituted a rapid review process for papers on COVID-19. Every COVID-19 article we publish is open access regardless of article type, and you can find them all at mja.com.au. If you are a researcher in the area and are looking to publish, please contact Dr. Francis Geronimo at fgeronimo, all one word, at mja.com.au for further details. Back to our chat. So if somebody, let's say an Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander, thinks they're being discriminated against and are not getting equitable access or what they believe they're entitled to as a right, what do they do next?
Well, the idea is that they won't need to do anything, Kate, because the Human Rights Act is set up as it's set up in a way that requires decisions at the front end to be made in contemplation of and compatibly with the human rights. So that's in the ideal world. And it's to apply across the entire public sector. And there's a very wide definition of the public entities that are captured by the legislation, from ministers to individual public servants. So the idea is that the Act is to help build a culture of human rights in Queensland where their human rights are understood, that they're respected, promoted and protected. And by ensuring, as I've said, we have human rights compatible legislation, we have a structure about how decisions are made, and then redress in the event of a complaint. So at that pointy end, if the worst case happens and the ideal world doesn't eventuate, there are specific steps that people can take to make a complaint. And I think Claire will come back to how that might incrementally improve the way the access to healthcare rights is improved, the way healthcare services are provided to our first Australians. But essentially there are three things people can do. They can complain to the decision maker in the first instance and try and get some redress face-to-face there. If that doesn't bring about a result that someone is satisfied with, they can take their complaint to the Queensland Human Rights Commission, either as a complaint about discrimination, I feel as though I've been discriminated against, and the Queensland Human Rights Commission still has the jurisdiction to hear and manage complaints under the Anti-Discrimination Act of Queensland. So nothing has changed. That Act is still there and people still have access to complain under it. Or it will run as a human rights complaint through the Human Rights Commission, and that will involve someone making their complaint. Usually the parties will be directed to attend for a conciliation to talk about the complaint and try and resolve it that way. And the Queensland Human Rights Commissioner has these residual powers too, where he can publish information about what's going on in those conciliations. So if he sees themes or issues that arise out of the complaints as a whole that warrant some kind of public alert, then he's got the power to make a report about that.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really powerful residual tool that he has in his kit.
Okay.
Otherwise, as Claire said, people can complain to the Office of the Health Ombudsman about health complaints and the Privacy Commission. And this Act, the Human Rights Act, and those acts which govern the Office of the Health Ombudsman and the Privacy Commissioner all kind of work together so that people can cross-refer to each other to the most appropriate organisation to manage the complaint.
Cool.
And then lastly, someone can go to court, but that's quite a complex process and is only available in very limited circumstances if the person has an existing cause of action upon which they can piggyback a complaint about a human right that the court can then adjudicate.
In addition to Megan's excellent summary, that if I have a complaint against health service provisions or concerns around discrimination,
with respect to my treatment by local GP, you know, our local GPs or working in private practice, they're not considered public entities under the Act.
Yes.
So if I had any complaint to be made, for example, as a health provider, I need to still, again, go to the private provider of the health service and you know, to them about the issue, and if I'm not satisfied, then the health ombudsman is the appropriate remedy and way forward.
That's correct. So the Human Rights Act applies to public entities or entities that are exercising functions of a public nature,
is
the way it's described in the legislation. That can bring in some of the private health providers if, for example, there's an agreement between the private entity and the government to alleviate waiting lists, for example.
Yeah.
So if there's an idea that the private sector is being funded in some way by the public, then that might be captured by the Human Rights Act. So I know that the private entities are at the moment trying to find a way to make sure that they're ready for their own compliance with the Human Rights Act for those discrete services.
In any event, that private health services, you know, they want to be compliant.
Yes, exactly.
They want to make sure that they provide high quality healthcare services that are indeed non-discriminatory. So it would make sense that, for me as a health rights specialist, that private services are captured. But as it stands, that's not directly so, but only in certain circumstances, as Megan alludes to.
Right, Claire, they have it's more of a social contract. They're not captured by this law, but they certainly, as we said at the beginning, health professionals are in a very unique position where most of what they do will always be compliant with human rights ideas anyway.
Yeah.
And certainly our private sector clients are definitely very keen to be to ensure that they measure up and look after their patients in every possible way.
What I would just like to highlight, I guess, in closing is that, and this was something that Megan and I discussed before, is how incredibly hard and amazing our frontline health service staff are in terms of what they're doing for the community in the most extraordinary circumstances that we find ourselves in. And in doing what they're doing, they're protecting and promoting Section 37. They're trying to ensure that every single Queenslander has a right to access health services without discrimination in these extraordinary times of public health emergency. I think that's just something that I would like to end with and just say how grateful I am to our frontline health workers.
Oh, absolutely. They're under enormous strain at the moment and doing an amazing job. The COVID-19 emergency, our Minister for Health and Ambulance Services did declare a public emergency under the Public Health Act on the 29th of January 2020, and that enlivened broadly the public emergency powers that can be exercised under Chapter 8 of the Public Health Act by a certain discrete and limited number of emergency offers with certain but very broad powers. They already had broad powers, but they're broader now under the emergency situation. And with the amendments that were made last week as well, the Chief Health Officer can now issue directions and they're being updated constantly to give effect to Commonwealth measures for strict travel restrictions, bans on indoor and outdoor gatherings, requiring people to self-isolate, to monitor, prosecute non-compliances, but also to advise businesses about what they can do with their operations to alter their trading hours, to restrict access at certain periods of time to vulnerable groups, as we've seen, so that's positive discrimination, and to provide advice, for example, about social distancing. So the human rights that might be impacted most out of those powers being exercised are obviously freedom of movement.
Yep.
The freedom of movement right is expressed as every person lawfully in Queensland has the right to move freely within Queensland, but also enter or leave Queensland.
Yes.
So these border restrictions that are being discussed will impact and limit on that right. The right not to have one's privacy, family or home unlawfully or arbitrarily interfered with, these powers will impact those rights. There's a right not to be arbitrarily deprived of property. So if businesses can't operate, that obviously impacts their ability to function. There's an internal limitation about the arbitrariness obviously this would not be considered arbitrary because there's a special public health reason for it, but there's no compensation payable under this emergency legislation for anybody who does suffer loss as a result of their businesses closing or any other powers being exercised under these emergency situations.
And is that why there's the government has to legislate for stimulus packages or compensation payments?
Yeah, so that's a separate, they have to design that separately.
Yeah, right.
But someone can't, so for example, someone can't go to court and say, I demand, you know, I want to make a claim for compensation because in complying with the emergency powers, I suffered a loss. That right has been taken away by the emergency powers. But you're quite right, there are lots of other things going on where the government is trying to make way for emergency packages for people to cope during this difficult time. Something like the right to access education might be impacted if the schools need to close. How does the government ensure that children are able to access the education that they have the right to under this legislation? An emergency officer in the medical, there's a special medical category, so certain doctors can sign off on orders that can keep people detained and force them to have medical treatment if they're in a certain group that is posing a risk and not being properly compliant with what's being recommended to them. And that can be under the new powers, under the changes from last week. It was 96 hours maximum. That's been extended to 14 days to contemplate. That's what the science is telling us around how long the incubation period might be for COVID-19. And obviously that brings into questions, right, we actually have a right to protection from torture and cruel and inhumane treatment, which Claire spoke to as being one of the non-derogable rights. That's where within that particular right is the right for people to have full and free informed consent to medical treatment. So obviously that right is impacted by a detention order that can be made, and obviously the right to liberty is impacted. We also have a right to humane treatment when we are deprived of liberty. So what does that mean if someone does have to be detained and placed into isolation? How do you make sure that's as humane as possible? Well, I'm sure our health staff are thinking about those things. Nearly all of the rights that are mentioned in the Human Rights Act and protected will be impacted by these public health powers and dealing with the COVID-19 situation.
And just to add, Kate, that, you know, many of these rights actually that are included in the Human Rights Act can be considered part of the cluster of the elements of the social determinants of health.
Yes.
Such as the right to education. So, you know, the right to property, because we know housing is such a key social determinant of health. The human rights complexities and the multidimensional challenges that COVID-19 has elicited vis-a-vis this new act and what's going to unfold in the coming months, I think it's going to create some very interesting times for people like Megan and myself who are in the human rights space, and for the most vulnerable, and for the doctors and the nurses and the health policy makers and planners. It's like I said, we're just in extraordinary times.
Thank you both.
Thank you so much, Claire, and you too, Kate.
My thanks to my special guests today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.